The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
we still, to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast.
So Mickey Kaus is a journalist and political blogger who started the website The Kaus Files in 1999. He has written for The New Republic, Newsweek, Slate, and The Daily Caller, and he is the author of the book The End of Equality. He is also the co-founder of Blogging Heads TV, along with Robert Wright, and he appears weekly with Robert in The Parrot Room. Mickey, welcome to the Zero Books channel. What is the name of the podcast you do with Robert?
I do two podcasts with Robert. One is just a regular iteration of his show called The Right Show on Blogging Heads TV. And then we do a sort of after party thing called The Parrot Room, where we talk about what we talked about and get more gossipy and personal, but also substantive. And we charge for that because Bob needs a new, and I need a new funding stream. He was relying on foundation grants, which have dried up. And I was relying on investments. That's what we call it. on investments.
Yeah.
Yes. And my investments are drying out too. So and we make a little money but a little money is better than no money at all. So
yeah. Well, I have a confession to make, which is I'm a fan of the show. I thought that you and Robert were talking about naming the public podcast something that would be different than just The Right Show, but at the moment I guess it's still just The Right Show.
We should, but why don't you make that point to Bob? He has other people on the show other than me, and he was reluctant to like make it a separate brand, but it causes some confusion. I agree.
Yeah. And I know you've discussed whether or not to give it a new name. The other thing I want to tell you is that at one of the episodes, Robert said, well, maybe this Parrot Room name will become commonplace and everyone will pick it up and it will just be what people call the show that they put in Patreon. And so I've done that. So we have our own Parrot Room here at Zero Books. So when I do a podcast with a guest and then keep them for a second hour, the second hour is the Parrot Room. And I have a regular co-host on something called Pop the Left. And every 2 weeks we do 2 hours, and one's for the public and one's a Parrot Room. So I'm hoping that Robert was serious about wanting people to steal the name rather than, you know, setting myself up in a lawsuit here.
You may be hearing from our counsel. I don't know. Anyway, it's flattering anyway. And it sounds like a good show. So,
yeah. So here's why I wanted to have you on. This is you know, Zero Books is a kind of a far left critical theory imprint out of the UK. I do podcasts and videos to promote the imprint and the books, and I've become, well, and you know, under Trump, navigating the left has become difficult. And one of the things I'm really interested in is how people move from the left to the right, and I think of you as someone who has made that journey. Would you say that's a fair estimation?
I resist that characterization. Most people agree with you. Most people would say I've moved from the left to the right. I certainly moved to the right from where I was in college, but I did vote for Trump twice. Mm-hmm. But I deny that I've really changed that much. For example, I'm still for a national healthcare system. I think I'm still for a large government. I wouldn't call it a welfare state. I would call it some kind of supportive state for workers. And I'm for funding it with large sums of taxpayer money. That's been constant. I'm for a large public sphere. And the issues where I've departed from the left are really, they're really only a couple of them, mainly immigration. On trade, the left is sort of, I'm moving toward the left on trade as opposed to, I used to be what would now be called a neoliberal on trade, which is let the market work its will and then redistribute the money from the winners to the losers. I don't buy that anymore. It never works and it's degrading to the losers. So I've moved to the left on trade. It's just the Democratic Party in the United States refuses to budge on immigration. So what are you going to do?
Well, back in your college days, were you a member of the Students for a Democratic Society?
Well, I went to college starting in 1969. Mm-hmm. And the big breakout year for student activism in the United States was 68. That's when there were the big strikes. And I missed that. So I missed out on all the drama of the revolution at college. But so we sort of tried to have our own revolution, which was sort of a wan imitation of the 68 revolution. But at that point, SDS had split into three parts. Mm-hmm. There was RIM 1, which was the Progressive Labor Party, which was a very sort of weird, hardcore sort of economistic Marxist group that sort of focused on like strikes over proletarian issues like wages for the local painters on campus. And they all wore blue work shirts to show their identity with the working class. And they were just too economistic. They were like, if you remember at the time, the theory was not that capitalism was impoverishing workers. The theory was capitalism was delivering the goods for workers. So that's the one thing capitalism did. And it was creating a hollow consumerist society with alienated workers. So alienation was the big new left theme. Mm-hmm. And that was carried by RIM 2, Revolutionary Youth Movement 2, the second group, which was sort of the group I affiliated myself with. There were no formal offices, and I was sort of a hanger-on, but there were bigger cheeses, many bigger cheeses in the movement on campus. We staged demonstrations, and they were supposed to be nonviolent, but somehow they always became violent. And then RIM 3, the third group, was the Weathermen, who staged the Days of Rage in Chicago and went on to various other not-so-illustrious exploits.
Right. So, I've been exploring on our channel the history of the left and of socialism, and I focused recently on a guy named Cornelius Castoriadis, but if you just look at the Frankfurt School in general, there was a thought after World War II, especially, that capitalism had worked out its contradictions, that the economy was not going to drive the proletariat to revolutionary fervor, instead, like you said, what was being created was a society of alienated, one-dimensional men, right? People who had their needs met but weren't free. Would you think that it sounds like the group you were aligned with, that you were part of, kind of would fit into that Frankfurt School monopoly capitalist perspective?
Yeah, that was I would say that was the consensus left-wing position on campus. I didn't read enough of the Frankfurt School myself. I did take 20 courses on Marx, so I read a lot of Marx, but did not read that much of the Frank. But the general consensus was capitalism I guess I have one caveat, which is we were always looking for a breakdown theory where capitalism would collapse sort of its own contradictions. My senior thesis was an attempt to come up with one of them, which is there were all these experiments at democratizing the workplace and giving worker participation and worker control over their workplaces. And my thesis was that the workers would demand more and more and more control until the capitalists couldn't stomach it, and there would be a big fight. So that was a sort of a breakdown theory that never, of course, took much hold. There were instances of capitalists giving workers control and having it get out of hand, but nothing in any way that came close to threatening the system. But so we were looking for a way that capitalism would collapse, but it wasn't going to collapse because it impoverished the working class.
Right, or so you thought. And
so we thought, yes.
Yeah. So that's really interesting. Do you remember when you were studying Marx, which particular interpreters of Marx were most influential on you? Like, do you remember a guy named Paul Sweezy?
I remember Sweezy. He was persuasive, but I guess I didn't quite know what to make of him. I guess Gortz was the big hero on campus. And that wasn't his real name, I don't think, but it was his pen name. And a lot of talk about the Grundrisse.
Look here.
Oh, okay. Is that it?
Sitting right here on my desk.
I guess Carl Oglesby was the main promoter of the Grundrisse. I guess those were the big ones, and the big economists on my campus were Herbert Gintis and Samuel Bowles, who were very, very smart people, and kept up the being on the left, I think, until for like 15 years after the revolution had died. Mm-hmm. So give him points for that.
Yeah. Well, I've been sort of working on this idea that the way that the left abandoned a more economistic understanding of Marx after World War II, particularly, but probably before that also in the 19th century, when there was a economic depression that was followed by a boom, that has led to confusion on the left and an abandonment of the aim of overcoming commodity production, and instead a turn towards managing capital through the state, because that's, you know, using monopoly capital and state capital to create socialism. So that's just so I'm. When I'm talking to you and I'm asking you what your interpretation of Marx is, I'm trying to confirm my theory that, you know, the reason he's on the right is because he has the wrong theory of Marx. Go ahead.
What the wrong theory of Marx was, which theory?
The theory that the contradictions of capitalism had been overcome, that state capitalism could manage those contradictions through big monopoly capitalist efforts, through, you know, basically a command economy run by the state, that competition was no longer dominating society, and that the market could be regulated, and right. And not that theory of capitalism, the idea that capitalism had reached this new phase, and that the old contradictions were overcome, I think was a mistake. And I think, you know, after 2008, especially, that idea doesn't hold water anymore.
Well, I think the problem started cropping up in the, in the 80s, when it became clear that incomes were growing more unequal. When I went to college, income inequality was not that big an issue. We thought the people at the bottom are getting richer, capitalism was sort of working for them. They were alienated, but they were getting richer. And then there was a lot of resistance, at least on my part, when in the 80s, people maybe mainly left labor economists like Irving Bluestone, I think was one of them, started saying, you know, incomes are growing more unequal. Eventually it turned out that they had the weight of evidence behind them and incomes really were growing more unequal and certainly felt like society in the 80s was growing more unequal. And then you have to confront that capitalism really wasn't working in that sense. And then it turned out that wages were actually stagnating at the bottom. So that made one less sanguine about how capitalism worked out all its kinks. And I really think that the other strain that you have to look at here is the strain of meritocracy that the incomes were becoming more stratified by basically education and smarts. That was an issue when I was on campus because Richard Herrnstein had come out with his big Atlantic article about how IQ was very important. IQ was inherited and therefore poverty was going to run in the genes like bad teeth. That was his analogy. And it was very controversial. And the Bowles-Guinness position, which was the radical left position, was, you know, the liberal position was, this is terrible. This doesn't happen. You know, we're a land of opportunity. People, intelligence isn't inherited anyway, you know, blah, blah, blah. And the left-wing position was, it's probably inherited. The smart people do get ahead, but that doesn't mean they should be paid more. That doesn't mean you have to, have income rewards on strict meritocratic basis. So that was always an issue, but it's more that not only was there income inequality, but the nature of the inequality changed. It wasn't just that some people got really lucky and rich and some people wound up poor. It's that smart people got rich and educated people got rich and uneducated and less skilled people stayed poor. And so we had a caste system forming and a form of social inequality and snobbery that sort of became more and more obvious that wasn't a good thing at all that capitalism was generating. So those two things were sort of became the big problems, not so much alienation. I think alienation is coming back, but that's, for most of my life and when I wrote my book, those were the two big issues.
Did you notice at the time that along with this meritocratic snobbery, there was also a wave of financialization that the industries that were successful were those that weren't necessarily directly responsible for commodity production, but were, you know, managing finances or holding property and collecting rent and that kind of thing. Well, so that would kind of explain why the intellectual class would do well, even as the everyday worker was struggling, is because the productive economy was actually struggling.
One noticed that, sure. I mean, in New York in the 80s, you couldn't miss it. I guess I never quite, when you design a railroad, you know, only a certain small percentage is the actual laying of the track and the hammering and the jackhammering and the building. And a whole lot of it is designing the railroad. And it's hard to say, which is a bunch of educated people with, you know, used to be slide rules, now with computers. And it's hard to say that there's a way around that. I mean, it's not like it's a flaw of capitalism that it's spent. The world is going in the direction where more and more of the work that needs to be done is intellectual work, what Robert Reich calls symbolic analysis. And less and less of the productive work is, grunt labor by unskilled people. And, and this is all in Michael Young's book on meritocracy. I mean, he sees all of this.
Right. But railroads are a great example because railroads don't really make profits based on the labor time invested in producing the railroads, like you said, but rather by holding the property. They collect rent, which is a different part of the economy. So the productive part of the economy is where real, if you hold with Marx's theory of labor theory of value, where the real value and growth of the economy happens is through commodity production, not through the collection of rent. But nonetheless, you have to have these landlords owning rent.
That's an interesting argument, and I wonder if it dovetails with arguments of capitalists like Peter Thiel, whose book I haven't read, but he seems to argue that the only way you make profits is if you have a monopoly or something.
Nowadays, but that's only because the tendency for the rate of profit to decline. You know, the way out of that is another great big depression where we could have the devaluation of capital and another boom like we did after World War II, where everyone seemed to be thinking that they were going to be raising the working class up forever and ever, and all the problems of capitalism were solved. I'm on my own. I'm on my usual hobby horse here. So, I think it's worth noting that the labor theory value aspect of Marx was not something that the New Left held on to that much, right? It was more about alienation and the sort of the inhumanity of capitalism.
Well, there were two different strains, but I was the New Left was more the first strain, and I guess Baran and Sweezy were more the second strain.
So let me ask you about Christopher Lash. Did you know him?
No, I didn't know him. I don't know if I don't know if I ever even saw him, and I haven't read him extensively, but everything I've read by him has been very smart.
Did you know that he mentions you at length?
Oh, yeah. I do. One does a Washington read, which is looking in the index for your name. And so I certainly did that. And I read those sections of the book. And so I'm familiar with that. Yeah.
You read The Revolt of the Elites, or at least the section that you were quoted in.
Right.
Lash seemed to agree with you that the most serious threat to equality doesn't come from the misdistribution or maldistribution of wealth, but more from the abandonment of public institutions in which citizens meet as equals. And I guess he's quoting you in your book, The End of Equality. And at that time, you were, again, probably very focused on the kind of the culture of capitalism and the cultural effects that the capitalism had on society, and the direction that it was going, the atomization and alienation of society. And so was Lash. Do you still hold with the views that you had in The End of Equality?
Pretty much. I've sort of made my, this is a bad way to put it, I've made my peace with capitalism as a productive enterprise way to run the economy. Mm-hmm. It has these horrible side effects. One of them is alienation and atomization, which is fought off by a public sphere in which we're all equal. Another thing is social inequality, which is, I thought, counteracted. In America, we're pretty good at containing the invidious implications of wealth by treating each other as equals. In other words, the classic example is George Orwell was amazed when there was a duchess who was evacuating from Dunkirk, and in the queue for the lifeboats that were going to take them back to England, she didn't jump the queue. She actually stayed in line and took her turn. And he thought, you know, the class system is over in England. It's just so fantastic. Well, in America, you don't jump queues. I mean, you know, when people do it, like John Kerry was famous for jumping the queue at his local market, do you know who I am? It's considered offensive and somewhat un-American. So we tend to be natural social egalitarians. And I thought the way that was enforced was through a robust public sphere, the classic example being the draft, where everybody was treated as an equal. Malcolm Forbes and John F. Kennedy would serve side by side with just ordinary schmoes who were, you know, pipe fitters and plumbers from local towns. And that was a strong egalitarian institution. Unfortunately, that's withered. My second hope was that some sort of National Health Service, like an expansion of Medicare, I think Medicare that covered 100% of the population, would bring everybody together, at least enough of the people together in the same medical institutions that they would consider themselves equal. This would fight off the tendency of the rich to think they were better than everybody else. There have been a couple of things since the book came out that have changed for me. One is I didn't care much about income equality, because when I wrote the book, the rich were getting richer, but the poor were getting richer too, just at a slower rate. So the gap was increasing, but at least everybody was going up.
Yeah, Margaret Thatcher made a lot of hay out of that. In her day, yeah.
Right, and it's in you know, Michael Young writes about it too. People aren't that upset as long as they're marching forward. If the rich are marching forward at a much faster pace, well, as long as they're making progress, they don't mind that much. And it turned out that but there is a sort of minimum income that people need to have a chance at a respectable, dignified life. And in the 80s, it looked like they were getting that. And in the 90s and aughts, it looked like they weren't getting that. So the wages at the bottom were just too low to enable the sort of dignified middle-class, lower middle-class, working-class life that would let these institutions of social equality do their thing. So I became worried about immigration and trade in a way that I was not when I wrote the book. And the second thing, I'm not sure that a strong public sphere, even if we could have one, which we don't, would be enough to contain all the forces of production, as Marx would say, because thanks to automation, it's not clear that there's even going to be work for unskilled people. You know, it's hard to participate as an equal if you have an income, even if there's a guaranteed income that you know, gives you whatever the basic minimum of money you need to participate in society is. It's hard to hold your head up if you're not earning that income and other people are, if you're just on the dole. So I'm not. I'm drifting toward some sense in which trade and immigration are going to have to be controlled to allow local production where everybody has a productive job, even if it means sacrificing efficiency and gross national product in the process, that would be the only way to assure social equality. It's not very well thought out, but that's certainly nothing that's in my book. My book is very neoliberal in the sense that it assumes the trade and I ignore immigration completely, but it assumes that trade and automation are creating more and more inequality, and we should let them run their course because that's efficient, and then we should redistribute the money from the winners to the losers. Mm-hmm. And and my line was, well, but we also need this public sphere to ensure social equality. But I don't think that model really works anymore, because losers who just get checks from the government and participate in the public sphere, I don't think that's enough to assure social equality.
Yeah. Well, go ahead.
No, I don't care about income, economic equality per se. I only care about economic inequality to the extent that it undermines social equality. I think the big thing is, and this was an aperçu that I had after I left law school. So it had nothing to do with the Marxists in the 60s, as far as I could see.
Right. Well, no, but that makes sense to me. I mean, I don't have any dispute with the idea that income is not the be all end all, that social equality you know, is would be the aim. You know, Marx said, from each according to his abilities, to each according to his needs, right?
Right.
So that's not equality.
Right.
So some people might have less and some people might have more.
I accept the sort of Michael Walzer revision of that, which is people who contribute to the productivity of society are rewarded with money. Fine. Let the people who are most productive get not according to their needs, but according to whatever they earn in the market. That's the way we produce things. But let's limit the sphere of money so that, people who make a lot of money in the marketplace, they get money. But that's all they get. And money is only money. They don't get greater respect because they're rich.
Right.
They get nicer cars because they're rich.
All I'll say about all that about your reinterpretation of Marx's lines is that after the revolution, I'll try to get you a nice spot in the camp.
Well, that's okay. That's sort of Michael Walzer. I think that it's not any particular contribution that I made. I ripped off Walzer and tried to popularize him.
But what I was trying to get to actually was. In that period when you were writing, right after you wrote that book, and in the 90s in the Clinton era, you were a proponent of welfare reform, and I was wondering how that went along with your realization that income inequality was a rising concern, that it was a real problem rather than a fake one, and how you thought welfare reform a la Clinton was going to help create social equality.
Well, it seemed essential to it because the only way to build social equality is in a community of workers where everybody shared at least some values, and the basic value that everybody could share was we all work for what we got. And if you could work at a minimum wage job, or you could work at a Wall Street firm, and you were all working, and the welfare state that I envision is the welfare state that sort of evolved, which is it was tied to work. In other words, Social Security is tied to work, the earned income tax credit is tied to work, and there was a whole sort of series of subsidies that went to workers. So if you worked, you got them, and it equalized the incomes and let everybody participate at least at some level in the economy, and they were all bound by the sense that everybody had to work. And that's a strong value among American voters and the work ethic. And it's sort of the glue that holds everybody together and enables social equality. That means you have to diss the people who don't work. And it looked like in the 60s, it looked like, sorry, in the late 20th century, that there was a group of non-workers. There was a group of non-workers on welfare who long-term just didn't do that much work at all. And it was hard to uphold the work ethic and say that these people could, people look down their nose at them. And you had to sort of say that, well, maybe they had a reason to, if you believe in the work ethic. And we should instead have a society that had a guaranteed job, WPA-like job, and made sure that everybody could work, and then everybody who took the job or took another job in the private economy would all be sort of socially equal. But that meant that there were some people who just refused or didn't take any jobs who would be sort of outside the pale. The second thing was that it was very Marxist in that it was an attempt to say, what is the mode of production of the so-called underclass economy mainly in urban areas with high concentrations of poverty? And the answer is the mode of production was welfare. And if you change the mode of production, you're going to change by ending welfare, you're going to change everything else about that society, specifically.
Source of income and spending, not what was the mode of production. Yeah.
Well, right. And you were going to change like family habits and, single women were going to get married before they had kids. So they had two earners. And there was a whole sort of optimism based on on what I think was a Marxist view of society, that if you change, just change this, the basis of how people get money and spend it, that everything else in the culture, which was epiphenomenal, would change. And that was sort of over-optimistic, I think, but that was the idea.
Yeah, well, I was working kind of a grunt-level job in the 90s. I had dropped out of college when my wife was pregnant with our first son, and he was born in 96. And so I went back to work. I worked for a physician's answering service at that time,
right,
taking calls. And when that legislation passed, suddenly we got an influx of young mothers who had to get work because they were no longer able to get welfare. Coming from rough areas in Portland, and complaining about being away from their kids, and also quite clearly not of the group of people who had gotten hired without the legislation. Their wages were supplemented by the state, so they were being, the company was being paid to hire these people. So there was clear divisions between the workers amongst those who were part of the program and those who weren't. And they often didn't last either. I remember just one particular woman who, had come back, she had drug problems and had a new baby, and she just hated having to go into work. So I just want to give you that anecdotal.
Well, were there tensions in the workforce? In other words, did the group?
Oh, it was a terrible job. Anyway, we were not well trained. We were taking emergency calls that none of us were trained to deal with. So we were very limited in what we could say to people. But ultimately, like if someone called up and say they were feeling suicidal, we had to make sure they reached a doctor. But we also had to assess whether it was an emergency call or not, or like if they called up with chest pains, we had to assess whether it was an emergency or not, because they often would tell us, but we weren't trained to make that assessment. And so like you would, every couple of days, someone would be told, well, because you didn't mark that as an emergency, that patient's dead. It was a dreadful situation, I want to, one more part of the story. Years later, I'm in another grunt job, selling cable for Comcast, taking calls and selling cable, and the economic crisis hits, and everyone's sort of panicked whether they're going to be able to keep their job. And one of the things that I remember being discussed, and that maybe it was because I was the one raising the issue, was the fact that the welfare programs that used to be there to catch people if things really fell apart had all been stripped away, and everything was now tied to work at a time when the jobs were disappearing. So I just want. So those are. Go ahead.
That's why I think a WPA guaranteed job, which we almost had in Wisconsin, is essential if you're going to tie things to work. That's a very interesting what you said, because in the statistics, the great success of welfare reform was that the mothers, single moms who were on welfare, they dramatically went into the workforce. The workforce participation jumped, and there's always a controversy. Well, did they really jump, or did they just jump in the? In other words, did they just jump at the statistics? In other words, were these people working all the time off the books, and it just after welfare their work went on the books, so it looked like they went into the workforce, or did they actually go into the workforce where they weren't working before? And it's obviously a little bit of both, but your example suggests that they really did go into the workforce. And Jason,
she might have been selling drugs before, right?
Right. But, well, Jason DePaul wrote a very good book called American Dream After Welfare Reform Passed, that sort of made this point, that it made two points that it drove home. One is that, despite all the Marxist theorizing that welfare was the basis for the economy of the ghetto, it was actually not as big as we thought. There was all these other sources of income, like drugs, and it was all a big confused mess where people pieced together income from working on the side and welfare and drugs and getting money from their boyfriends, and changed the welfare piece. You weren't changing as much of it as you thought.
Yeah. But I want to point out one other thing about my story. I'm in Portland, Oregon, which is one of the whitest cities in the country. So the people that I was talking about were all white, by the way. They just to not racialize it in people's heads. But anyway, because I started to think of it that way with the ghetto talk. But it was for working class and poor people who lots of people, the majority of people on welfare were white people.
Right. The majority of people on welfare over a course of a year are white people. But if you look at the people at any one time, if you took a slice of welfare, it's a lot less white than the overall figure would lead you to believe. And as welfare reform chased people into the workforce, the caseload became blacker and blacker, and it's more black and Latino than it was before. It's also half the size. The welfare caseload got cut in at least half, probably more than half. But the second thing was, it did force people, and Jason's book is about the ghetto. It's not about white people, it's about African Americans. And it did force people into the workforce, like your experience. And you had the experience with whites, but it forced black people into the workforce. And for a lot of them, it was a good thing, because they learned that they were, Jason follows mainly this one woman who's living this crazy life with her boyfriends and welfare and their guns and drugs. And she has to take a job as a assistant in a assisted living facility, changing bedpans and sheets and it turns out she's good at it because she has human qualities that relate to the patients. They like her. She likes taking care of them. And she would never have done this if she hadn't been pushed out into the workforce. Right. So, and she's also meeting people who are outside the ghetto. So there was a good thing in the phenomenon that you observed.
Yeah. Wouldn't you say, though, a jobs guarantee program along with that kind of welfare reform would have been the perfect solution? I think you just did, because.
Yeah. Oh, totally. But in Wisconsin, which is what Jason's book is about, it's about Milwaukee. They supposedly had that program, which was called W-2, where a Republican governor, Tommy Thompson, actually had a workfare job that was, inherently not as tough as a private sector job, but didn't pay quite as well. But it came with health insurance. And I don't know if that I'm derelict in not knowing if that program has atrophied, if it still exists. My hope when welfare reform passed was that program would sweep the nation. It obviously didn't. It got a little foothold in New York because the Wisconsin welfare director went to New York. I think it has atrophied, and that's a bad thing, and it needs to be revived. And if you want to call it the WPA, that's great, because the WPA was a good thing, and it sort of makes it seem less punitive than workfare, even if they're basically the same thing.
Yeah. Well, I just feel like without nationalized or state-run daycare centers that are free for working-class people, expanded maternity leave, with government support, so that a woman who has an 8-month-old child isn't forced to go to work, and a job guarantee, that what you have with welfare reform is a way to, if you're worried about immigrants coming in and driving down wages, it's also the case that pushing single mothers into the workplace might also drive down wages in a situation where jobs are hard to come by, when the jobs start to go away and things are extremely competitive and there's no cushion, that it's not necessarily.
It would drive down wages, but that's all the more reason to protect them from having to also compete against desperate, unskilled immigrants. So they're Americans. So we have to find jobs for everybody. But yes, it would have the effect of driving down wages. But that's
How about
that puts more pressure on
why not just make it so that everyone who comes into the country who's looking for work and who gets hired has to get a living wage. There's a job guarantee for everyone in the country who's there as a citizen, you know, or legally. So so that you can't hire people at substandard wages and create these sweatshop conditions, rather than worrying about like blocking people at the borders. Just
on the
capitalist class.
I mean, you can't have that, all those guarantees, which I support, and also have tell anybody in the world they can come and take advantage of these guarantees. Half the world would move here. You have to have some.
You have to have some
control of the border.
Yeah,
to enable that.
But the problem right now is that you have this. It's not so much that the people that want to come here. It's the fact that you have these industries which rely on basically slave labor to survive.
Oh, the people want to come here. They're backing up at the border right now in anticipation of the Biden presidency. We had these huge migrations, and it wasn't because capitalists wanted them. It was because they wanted to move here to take advantage of what our capitalists offer them. So
they come here illegally. They're not getting legal jobs, and they're not getting legal wages. And often they're super exploited. And if there weren't industries that could do that were somehow getting away with hiring workers at slave-like conditions or really low wages, then there wouldn't be a mass of people coming over the border, because they wouldn't have anywhere to go to. They wouldn't have the opportunities such as they are wouldn't exist if we had more control over our industries
because it would be illegal to hire illegal immigrants.
It would just be illegal to hire people for below living wages. If you want to hire someone who's not an American citizen, fine, you still have to pay them
this is a difficult argument to counter, but I think the problem with that is even at the same wage, even if you say there's a minimum wage of $12 an hour, okay?
Say 15.
The immigrants will still take the jobs because employers would rather hire immigrants than Americans. It's the dirty little secret of the immigration debate is, you know, people on the right, they tar the immigrants as, largely criminal, and they're, you know, they don't speak English and they're just terrible people. They're not terrible people. They're excellent workers, and the employers would rather hire them than Americans. So at $15 an hour, the American is going to be out of a job. And the problem is we have to take care of everybody in our society, even Americans who aren't as good workers as the people coming over the border. And we have to have jobs for them, too. And just guaranteeing a minimum wage does not provide jobs for the Americans who are, you know, the African Americans will tell you they're the last hired and the first fired. And I've come to conclude that they're right about that. And in order, you know, when there's a really tight labor market, they get hired and they do fine. But the preference of employers is always for I'll take the desperate guy from over the border who will work, you know, long hours and not complain about it versus the American. That's just the way it is.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I don't think that you're entirely wrong, although I suspect that that kind of preference for immigrants, which would be have less of an impact on the overall economy or in the incomes than you might be claiming. But I don't think that you're entirely wrong that, you know, people who come from rough conditions are quite happy with, you know, America and the kinds of jobs they could get, especially at $15 an hour, and would be far less likely.
Yeah.
To complain. I don't doubt that at all. But let's go back to FDS and 69 because it seems to me like one of the things I enjoy about watching Blogging Heads and all its different variations, but also sort of get frustrated with, is watching people with such sincere intentions, good intentions, shill for capitalism and act as if there's no other possibility, that you know, really get into the weeds, but always within this little tiny box. But what happened to the dream of like changing society radically and getting to the foundations of society, so we don't have all these myriad of problems that can never quite be solved? No matter, you know, every solution you try just creates another problem over here. What happened to the revolutionary spirit, Mickey?
Well, it went somewhere. I mean, I do not share the optimism about remaking society from top to bottom that I did have in the 60s. I mean, when you went for college in the 60s, you were convinced your life was not going to be, the society that you grew up in wasn't going to be anything like the society as it existed then. Capitalism was doomed. It just wasn't going to be there when you were an adult. Okay. Mm-hmm. And that didn't happen. And the economy actually proved to be quite productive, and it achieved all sorts of material accomplishments that societies that claim to be socialist didn't achieve. So one sort of gave up on this idea of a top to bottom rejiggering of production. And then, you know, I rationalized it on the basis of, you know, is it really that important if some people are rich and some people are less rich? I mean, Tawney called these the details of the counting house. Okay. It really doesn't matter. As long as everybody has a decent life and they treat each other as equals, some guys drive Rolls Royces, some guys drive, Daewoos, and, it doesn't really matter. That was my rationalization. And, the attempts to deny, people who are more productive, more money as incentives, and to have that be the way, the market be the way that basically goods are allocated, haven't worked very well. So that's the argument, and I'm open to it working well in other ways, but I'm just sort of, and I agree that. In some areas like healthcare, for example, we don't want the market to work its will. So I'm open to it. I just, as a practical matter, it just doesn't seem, like the main chance.
Well, I was born about 20 years after you. I was born in December of 1970. And, so I just turned 50. My God. But for my generation, or for me anyway, I didn't think capitalism would be around when I was an adult, because when I was a teenager and younger, I didn't think the world was going to be around when I was an adult. I thought, do you remember the TV special The Day After?
Sure. And the march across America for the nuclear freeze. I remember all that stuff.
Second takes you beyond imagining, beyond tomorrow, and into the day.
So I was convinced we were at the edge of doom.
It's not crazy anyway. It's still a viable possibility that we may blow each other up. So don't give up on that.
Well, I don't want to. I would like to give up on it. It's not a real positive vision. But I just felt like, as I entered into my adulthood, I felt like, well, look, these are the world is really out of balance. The world is really unsafe and seemingly still headed towards the dustbin. And it's my job as the next great American novelist. And by the way, I've written a few novels that to change it, to attach myself to the most radical elements for good in society. That's where that's how I've ended up where I am today. I feel that, like, one of my favorite philosophers, Slavoj Žižek, says, the real utopian dream is capitalism forever. Utopia is this idea we can maintain the system, which is going crazily out of sync, or, it's toppling over every day. So I would just challenge you to, you know, what do you have to lose now? I would challenge to pick up the Grundrisse or Calculus.
We have a lot to lose now, but
career wise,
what I do? No,
you could become a Marxist crazy man, and it wouldn't do. It would be better for you than being a Trump supporter.
Well, being a Trump supporter is not an option anymore. He's gone, and he's discrediting himself. So that's not a viable option. But the you are right in the sense that one of the basic truths of Marxism, I think, is that every system creates the circumstances of its own demise, and contradictions well up into every system, even a capitalism that has in theory vanquished socialism is probably developing contradictions in ways that we don't even see that will ultimately lead to its demise or transformation. You look at communist China, they're sort of capitalist, but in theory, my version would be that they would have to become democratic in order to join to achieve the fruits of real fruits of capitalism. They don't seem to believe that, and they're being quite successful maintaining a horrible authoritarian system while harnessing some aspects of a market economy. So that's a horrible way that capitalism might evolve. And all over the world, people are gravitating toward industrial policies and sort of state-run schemes to sort of steer the market in one direction or another. And I'm for that in the United States. I've made my peace with industrial policy, and that seems to be the wave of the future. But they're also moving away from democracy itself. Mm. So it's not a democratically selected industrial policy. It's selected by the commissioners of the European Union. And I mean, the reason I'm for Brexit is the EU is just not democratic. It's run by bureaucrats and is not all that dissimilar from communist China in that respect. And Britain wanted to be a democracy, so they broke off. The legislature that's elected in the EU does not have the power to propose laws. They can only vote yes or no on the laws that the bureaucrats give them to vote on. Well, that's not a democracy. The whole world is drifting toward industrial policy, and it's drifting away from democracy while maintaining a capitalist sort of engine underpinnings. And I don't know if that's stable. Is that a stable system? Probably not. So you're completely right that evolution is not over. Even if you'd want it, even if you want to freeze it right now, it's going to evolve into something else. And I don't know what that something else is.
Thanks for watching this Zero Books video. If you enjoyed it, subscribe to this channel and click on the notifications bell so that you'll be alerted whenever we release a new video. You should also consider supporting us on Patreon. Our patrons get access to our Inside Zero Books podcast every week and can get access to the Zero Books book club and help us to continue making online content from the left.